Well, last week, Amber Riggs spoke and knocked it out of the park, didn't she? Isn't it so good? So good. She took us through Ruth chapter 3, the steamy chapter, where our Moabitess hero goes to Boaz in the middle of the night, and you think a seduction scene is coming, and then it doesn't come, and instead, a marriage proposal happens. And Ruth asks Boaz, this rich man, to become her kinsman redeemer, that is to marry her and to take her into his care along with her mother-in-law, Naomi, and he says yes. Now, we started this whole study on this book of Ruth talking about cultural differences and cultural gaps that are hard for us to get over. These are real people. Very ordinary people in their day, but they're not ordinary in our day. They live very differently. That is, we talked about, you know, the most significant detail for our purposes in this study is the fact that there was no state welfare system, no state security system at all, and a poor person and a widow had to be taken care of by the oldest male relative in the household, a patriarch who would bring her in. And he would do that by marrying her, even if he was already married. It was called Levirate marriage, and it almost always meant multiple wives. That probably seems very strange to you. It does to me. I don't really want to live in that society very much because I have one wife and I'm perfectly happy with that one wife. But it was the tribal, you know, this is the way tribal cultures worked. Did she make a face? Is that what happened? This is the way tribal cultures worked, and it's why it eventually was written into the Mosaic Law. This is the way it worked. Now, we already talked about this a few weeks ago, so why am I bringing it up again? Because I have to break something to you guys, and you're not going to like it, okay? Are you ready for it? Boaz was almost certainly married already. No! Almost certainly. You guys, here's the thing. Remember, Ruth is in her mid-20s, right? She's been married 10 years. Boaz makes a point of saying that he's much older than she is. He would have probably been, most scholars think, at least in his 40s. He was a landowner. He had many people working in his household, and he probably already had descendants he was passing stuff off to. It would have made zero sense in this culture for Boaz to be single. It doesn't make any sense to interpret it that way. He was almost certainly married. Bachelors did not last into their 30s back. I mean, you'd be married in your 20s. You would not, it's certainly not into your 40s. Now, it is possible that he was already, or that his wife had passed away and he was a widower. That is possible. The text does not mention any of that. But I want to say this. The integrity of Boaz does not depend on that, okay? This was the culture. This was the way it worked to take care of these people. Boaz probably was a married man and already had children and already was going to give his inheritance to these children and had to take care of them. And by marrying Ruth, he was agreeing to take on an additional family. Are you with me? Are you mad at me? This is why the story doesn't work, as I say, really as a modern romance, does it? Because you put in some of these details, you're like, oh, that makes it a little bit different. Now, it could have been also a romance in this context, but this is a very, very different culture, right? Okay, it's like I say, it's not a modern romance. It is a survival story. A survival story. Ruth asks him, you know, will you take us in and take care of not only me, but Naomi and our children and make sure we have an inheritance? Like, all it's a really, really big ask. And Boaz says yes. In fact, now he really wants to because he realizes this is a really special woman. He seems to want to marry her now. He seems quite taken with her at this point, but it is a costly thing that he's doing. So this brings us into the final chapter where all the legalities come into play. And admittedly, it's less compelling than the previous chapter. We go from a scandalous rendezvous at midnight to a less steamy city council meeting in the morning. But hang with me. I promise it'll be worth it, okay? Ruth chapter 4, verse 1. We've just discovered there's another man in the village who is also Ruth's relative, and he's a closer relative than Boaz, actually. So this guy, we say, had first dibs. So Boaz has to talk with him, and this is just after hours after this encounter with Ruth. Verse 1, Boaz went to the gate of the town and sat down there. Soon the family redeemer Boaz had spoken about came by. Boaz said, "Come over here and sit down." So he went over and sat down. And Boaz took 10 men of the town's elders and said, "Sit here," and they sat down. Let's pause there. Researchers tell us that the gate area in Israelite towns was almost like a market, all right? And in the morning, there would be a flurry of activity. Everybody passing through the gate, going to work, stopping at the food truck to get coffee and donuts. It would have been a flurry of activity, right? So if you wanted to find someone there in the morning, this is exactly the place you would go. Okay, so who are these elders he's mentioning? Well, we don't know who specifically they are. But the elders in the town would have been people like Boaz himself. Landowners, patriarchs, right? These are tribal villages, so these heads of household would have been the important ones to come and meet with to do any legal activity, all right? Not illegal activity. You wouldn't want them around if there's illegal activity. These guys were the law, okay? Lawyers, judges, policemen. This is the law, okay? So he wants to make sure these people are there. Okay, verse 3. Boaz said to the Redeemer, "Naomi, who has returned from the territory of Moab, is selling the portion of the field that belonged to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should inform you. Buy it back in the presence of those seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you want to redeem it, do it. But if you don't want to redeem it, tell me so that I will know, because there isn't anyone other than you to redeem it, and I am next after you." Now, who is not mentioned in that proposal? Ruth. Yeah, interesting, right? Here's the thing. We haven't talked much about this portion yet, about the land portion. We've talked about the people. So let me just get you a little bit of understanding here, hopefully, about what this is all about. The important thing for us to understand is, in a patrilineal society like they had, the land always stayed with the family. Every 50 years, there was something called the Year of Jubilee. And then all debts would be canceled, and land which had been sold would go back to the original family. Okay? That means if you bought land from one of your friends, then you would have to give it back to him at the Year of Jubilee, you know? So in essence, if you bought it, what are you really doing? You're really leasing it. Okay? That was how that worked. It was really a lease. Are you with me? I know this isn't like super exciting stuff here, but just again, hang with me. So let's go back in time a little bit. When Elimelech and Naomi had first left Bethlehem during the famine, this was years before, he probably didn't leave that land unattended. He almost certainly would have leased that out to someone and said, "If you can get something to grow in here, go for it. I've got to survive," right? Left. Almost certainly would have leased it. And now, years later, Naomi's back. Now, we don't know how far away they are from the Year of Jubilee, but at this point, it almost doesn't matter. She's a woman, so she can't own land anyway. She's penniless, so she can't buy it back from the person who is leasing it currently. However, this guy, who they're talking to at the gate right now, being a relative of the deceased, can buy it back for himself if he wants to. And in verse 4, he says, "Yes, I want to redeem it." This makes, you know, it makes perfect sense why he would want to, because consider this. Elimelech and his entire line are gone. So he could buy this land and not have to give it back to anyone, because there's no one to give it back to. He's the closest relative. That sounds like a pretty sweet business deal. It's not every day you can actually acquire more land in this tribal society. But now he has the opportunity to. So he's seeing dollar signs going, "Sweet, I love this idea. Yes, indeed, let me buy the land. Yes," so he tells all the people in the presence of these men, "Yes, I want to." Verse 5. Then Boaz said, "Oh, by the way," it's not in the text, "on the day you buy the field from Naomi, you will acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the deceased man, to perpetuate the man's name on his property." Interesting. Let's go to the Tyndale Commentary on Judges and Ruth. This was written by Mary Evans. Do we have that quote there, Mark? Here's what she says. At this point, Boaz brings in the second requirement, and the 10 witnesses provide no opportunity for the relative to ignore or sidestep this extra responsibility. Whoever buys the land is agreeing to marry Ruth the Moabite, and the land will be given to her first son to maintain the name of her dead husband, Mahlon. Keep going. In other words, the whole process should be seen now as an act of charity rather than as a profitable business deal. At first, he's like, sweet, I'm going to make money. And then he finds out Ruth is along with it. He's like, I'm going to make no money. And right away, you can see the poor guy's face just fall, you know, because he's trapped. Like, he was all in. He really wants the land for business. And this is happening, you know, if this was happening in private, he might have been able to ignore the Ruth situation. The fact that they left and that Ruth is a foreigner, that throws the whole his whole obligation into limbo. It's, you know, kind of theoretical. Like, oh, how do we handle this? I mean, yes, levirate marriage is the law, right? But this is a little bit more complicated. She's not just any foreigner. She's a Moabitess. And according to the Mosaic law, Moabites were not even supposed to be welcome in the assembly of Israel in the first place. This is why Dr. Richter, who taught us this, she said, she started out this whole seminar saying, Ruth was essential, would have essentially been considered an illegal immigrant. So you understand why he might have thought he could get away with quietly shirking this responsibility. This is a really gray area. But now that Boaz has brought this up in front of all the elders, he can't duck it. It's hilarious. He can't duck it. So the Redeemer replied, I can't redeem the land myself or I will ruin my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption because I can't redeem it. Now, this would have been a big embarrassment for him, culturally. A big embarrassment that he would have had to admit, I can't do it. He was worried there wouldn't be enough for him and his family if he brought in the stranger. And probably he was worried about his own reputation too, having a Moabitess wife. So he says no. Boaz, however, will not refuse. Let's look at verse 7. This is one of the ways you can tell this was written way later because it's referring to past tense. At an earlier period in Israel, a man removed his sandal and gave it to the other party in order to make any matter legally binding concerning the right of redemption or the exchange of property. This was the method of legally binding a transaction in Israel. So the Redeemer removed his sandal and said to Boaz, buy back the property yourself. Here's my croc. Take it, Boaz. I can't. Okay? Here. I wonder, you know, what else? Did he walk around like that the rest of the day? I don't know. Were there sandals for sale right around the market? Who knows? Verse 9. Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses today. I am buying from Naomi everything that belonged to Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife to perpetuate the deceased man's name on his property so that his name will not disappear among his relatives or from the gates of his hometown. You are all witnesses today. Let it be known. All the people who were at the gate of the city, including the elders, said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make this woman who is entering your house like Rachel and Leah. Isn't that interesting? Who together built the house of Israel. May you be powerful in Ephrath and your name be well known in Bethlehem. May your house become like the house of Perez, the son of Tamar, born to Judah. Because of the offspring the Lord will give you by this young woman. This is quite a blessing, isn't it? I don't think they normally gave these kinds of blessings for land deals. You bought a parking lot. May it be blessed. No. This is special because they're recognizing he's doing something quite extraordinary. You guys, all throughout this entire story, Boaz goes above and beyond the mere requirements of how you're supposed to treat somebody. The entire time. He was supposed to leave some food for gleaning. But he doesn't. He leaves a bunch of food for gleaning. He was supposed to allow the widows and the strangers to glean. But he goes further, offering her his protection. He even invites her to eat with them. These are things that do not happen. He gives food to the two women and shows great kindness and favor to them all throughout the harvest. And now he decides to give these women a home and bring them into his Bet Av, his family compound, the Father's house. Now, all throughout this book, we've seen this word redemption. And it feels like such a churchy, it's either a churchy word or a sportsy word, you know? We use a lot in sports, you know, like, oh man, he threw three interceptions the first half, but really redeemed himself in the fourth quarter, you know? He threw a touchdown and won the game. We use it for things like that, like he kind of made up for something. But I hope you can see this picture that the author has been painting this entire book. Redemption is not just a churchy word or a nebulous thing. It had a very real, solid meaning. Let's quote Dr. Richter again. In Israel's tribal society, redemption was the act of a patriarch who put his own resources on the line to ransom a family member who had been driven to the margins of society by poverty, and she lists some other things there, either by their own fault or someone else's. Redemption was the means by which a lost family member was restored to a place of security within the kinship circle. That's what redemption actually means. Friends, are you starting to see why this story might be in the Bible? It's not just because of Ruth's great-grandchild, David. It's because this idea, what Boaz is doing, tells the entire story of Scripture. Who are we? We're children of God. What happened to us? Well, we were taken out of our Bet Av, our Father's house. Sin happened. Disease happened. Abuse happened. Death happened. And we were left as broken outsiders without a way forward. Was it our fault? Well, yes, some of it, no, not at all. But you know what? It didn't matter whose fault it was because our patriarch pursued us. Our father reached outside the Bet Av and brought us back by an act of immense sacrifice. Are you getting this yet? Are you seeing how this points forward to Christ? You guys, what's more, Dr. Richter makes this point powerfully in her book, The Epic of Eden, which I highly recommend. She talks about how we always talk about, man, I can't wait till I get my mansion in heaven, you know? And like all the jokes about the different mansions in heaven and these things, and we talk about it like, hey, man, I can't wait. I'll get my mansion. Guess what, guys? That's not true. You don't get a mansion in heaven. That is such a weird American heresy. Like, are we that materialistic? I can't wait to get there because I really want those skylights. You know? Like, what are we doing? Oh, my mansion's going to have an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Fine, you just go right ahead. But that's not where you're going. You don't get a mansion. You don't get your own house. You get to go to his house. How much more beautiful is that, friends? We're not some weird individualist religion. We are a corporate, we are a family, and we have a father. That's what this story is about. Christ restoring us to the family circle, bringing us back to our Bet Av. You know who got this right in the 90s? Audio Adrenaline. Ah! It's a big, big house, they say, with lots and lots of rooms, a big, big table with lots and lots of food. It's a big, big yard where we can play football. It's a big, big house. It's my father's house. That's the gospel. It's so cool. By redeeming Ruth and Naomi, Boaz is giving us a foretaste of what Christ himself will eventually do. The ultimate kinsman redeemer, opening the door for us, the broken, the poor, the outsider, and making us family. Can I show you something cool? Some of you guys have seen this. Some of you probably haven't. In the very first chapter of the New Testament, we get a genealogy of Jesus Christ. Those long begots, you know, and you just glaze over, and us Westerners always skip to the actual story. Genealogies were very important. And in two little verses of the genealogy, we see this, verse 5 of Matthew 1. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. You guys, the text is screaming at us, as Dr. Richter would say, screaming. What is it telling us? What do you notice about this genealogy of Jesus? There are three women. Women were never in genealogies. This is completely abnormal. They would not list women in genealogy. Matthew lists three. What do you notice about these? Who are they, by the way? Who's the first one you see? Rahab. Who's Rahab? A prostitute. Where is she from? Jericho, which is Canaan. It's a Canaanite woman who is a sexual sinner. God, are you with me? Who's the second one? Ruth. Where is she from? Moab. What have we learned about Moab? This is enemies, right? Just like Adam. Now, who else do we see? Bathsheba, though she's not named, right? Uriah the Hittite. He's also a foreigner. Hittites were also from the Canaanite region. All these things. Do you think Matthew wants to tell us something? He is screaming at us. He is screaming at us. These women have reputations for better or for worse. Foreign women, enemy foreign women. See, guys, if you're Matthew and you're writing a story of Jesus and you want to make really good propaganda about how Jesus is the Messiah, you do not put these names in there. It would have been a slap in the face to the early cultures of the day. And Matthew, it puts them in under the unction of the Holy Spirit. He puts them in. You know why? I think because God really, really loves the outsider. These women are a part of the family of Jesus. They were outsiders, but God brought them into the household, the bet av of the Father. He brought them into the genealogy of our Lord and Savior. Incredible. And apparently he wants us to know that God really, really loves the foreigner. You know what I think is really strange? Seriously, I think this is strange. That so many people today, especially those who are chronically online or politically obsessed, hear words like inclusion or they hear words like diversity and they have this knee-jerk reaction against the concept. Now, I know why that is, because there's weird things like this. But it's like those are somehow have become like bad, unchristian things. Friends, let me introduce you to the history of Christ Center Church. Some of you guys were here for this. Some weren't. I was only here when I visited one time. We used to have this thing called the International Alliance. How many of you guys were ever here for an alliance meeting? How were they? Were they good? They're all a bunch of boring white people, right? No. There were churches from all over the world. You had black churches, you had white churches, you had Native American churches. There were Latinos, Asians, Islanders, Africans, Europeans. They had cowboy church, and then the Native American church, they always used to joke, there were cowboys and Indians. You had people like Mikey Obar, people with disabilities who would get up and preach. It was this incredible mix. Every tribe, tongue, and nation celebrated with great gusto. It was a foretaste of the marriage supper of the Lamb, where every single kind of person that's out there, every single kind of person, every single kind of sinner was invited. You know why? Because it's a big, big house. That was our history. So you guys, let's do away with trying to cram in our spirituality into these weird political camps that are mostly led by people yelling into the wind online. It won't work. It never does work. Don't listen to those people. Diversity is a major theme of the good news. Inclusion of all kinds of people is a major theme of the good news. The announcement that Christ is King, who includes Jews and Gentiles of every kind. People with every kind of culture, every kind of ability and disability. This isn't wokeness, friends. It's literally the gospel of Jesus Christ. Literally the gospel. Do you hear me? And it's told so beautifully in the book of Ruth. Oh, the man with one sandal says, no, I can't care for the outsider. It's too costly to me. They'll take up too much of my food. I don't know if I'm ready to trust God that far. And the other says, I will do it. I'll give them a family. I'll give them a future. And they are redeemed. They are redeemed in the biblical sense of redemption. Worship team, can you come back? Now, we're not done yet, okay? How many of you guys are furious with me right now? Hopefully none of you. I've stepped on toes this morning. But it's in here. This is the book. Okay, you ready for this? Verse 13. Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. He slept with her, and the Lord granted conception to her, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord, who has not left you without a family redeemer today. May his name become well known in Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. Indeed, your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. Naomi took the child, placed him on her lap, and became a mother to him. The neighbor women said, a son has been born to Naomi, and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. 4 weeks ago, Joshua asked, who is this book about? And we were right in the mic asking, you guys. And I know the obvious answer, oh, it's about Ruth. And that's true, but I tend to lean more toward Naomi, you know? Because in Naomi, we see the greatest change happen. Years ago, I was at a church conference with some of our fellow pastors. And it was the end of the night, and I had been going through a lot of really, really hard stuff, and I came forward for prayer. I hate going forward for prayer and things like this because then I feel like all the attention's on me. But I did, and I'm like, here's all the stuff going on, and I was this big mess, a snotty mess. All these people praying for me. It was this beautiful, good time, but also, you know. And so I ended up, like, I was like at the front of the church. I'm, like, laying down the front chairs as people are still praying for me. And there's this one guy. I've told this story before, so forgive me. One guy comes up to me. I remember he had, like, MacGyver hair. And he comes and he takes my finger. And he starts holding my finger. And people are praying for me, and he's holding onto my finger. But it's not just that. He's looking at me like this. And I'm like, do you remember that guy? Do you remember? You do. Okay. He's going like this. And they're still praying. And I'm like, you know, one eye open. I'm like, yeah, oh, it's good, it's good. And the other eye open, and he's still there going. Like, this is so weird. And he goes on. And a few minutes go by, and they're still. And finally, whew, they're done. And people start walking away. And there he's, and he kind of lets go of my hand. And I look down at him, and he's like, so I've been holding your finger. I'm like, yes, I know. And he said, I did it because it's awkward and because it's intimate and it's almost inappropriate. But I did it so you would not forget that one day you will take that finger and you'll think back at all the broken things of your life and be able to point, look at all the things that God has done. You guys, that's where Naomi is. How did she begin in this book? Do you remember? She was humiliated. Now she's honored. She was penniless. Now she lives in the home of a wealthy man who's going to take care of her. She was without family. Now she's surrounded by family. She had no inheritance. Now she will have sons to carry on the family name. She was Mara. She was bitter. And now she laughs tears of joy. Look at all the things that God has done. That is the story of Naomi. And that is the joy of the redeemed. You guys, we're going to play a song now, and it's kind of a little bit awkward. Maybe a little inappropriate for a serious sermon. But I want to do it today because I want you all to remember what redemption actually is and that you have been redeemed. Why don't you just stand?